listening today. We'll go out with Buffy St. Marie and the Universal Soldier.
A Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting this way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die.
Hey KV listeners, this is Stella from the Youth Collective reminding you to tune in Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7pm for our public affairs show. We have a whole collection of interesting pieces on politics this month ready for your ears. We'll talk about recent events in Baltimore, explore the history of politically fueled music, and share our opinions on corruption. It's a show you will not want to miss. So sit back, turn up the volume, and turn into KVOO 90.7 FM, Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7pm for your slice of current events on the underground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolution, the force that works underground even long before it bursts forth. The Old Mole Variety Hour comes to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patsy Kahlberg. This Memorial Day, we will be talking about not only militarism and the military, but also about education and activism and history. Bill Resnick will be talking with radical teacher and education activist Jesse Hagopian, who'll be a keynote speaker at Saturday's Labor Notes Troublemaker School. Then I'll share some thoughts from a Reynolds High School teacher about the role of Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, JROTC, JROTC, with some ideas on resisting militarism in schools. Desiree Helliger's reports on her recent trip to Vietnam and the continuing effects of Agent Orange. Finally, Clayton Morgeridge shares thoughts from a veteran who does not want us to say thank you for your service. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab. Those audio posts generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter to find out when the week's show is posted online. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Contact us if you're doing activism, planning events, engaging in movement that our other listeners will want to know about. We'd love to hear from you. We'll turn now to Bill Resnick's conversation with Jesse Hagopian.
Jesse Hagopian, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate being on the show.
Jesse Hagopian teaches at Garfield High School in Seattle, where he teaches history and social studies and advises the Black Student Union. He's become nationally known for leading resistance and resistance from teachers, students, and parents to high-stakes testing. He's also an editor of the journal Rethinking Schools and editor of the recent book that exposes high-stakes testing, More Than a Score. Schools are more than a score, and students are more than a score. Jesse Hagopian will be in Portland next Saturday at the Labor Notes Troublemakers School. He'll be the keynote speaker addressing social justice unionism, that is, ways unions and communities can come together to oppose corporate-style reform. Jesse's goals, winning gains, including much better schools. Jesse Hagopian, tell us about how you became a teacher and why you got into activism.
I began teaching in Washington, D.C. in 2001, which was an auspicious year to begin teaching because it was also the year No Child Left Behind Act came online that really began this current era of test and punish that has defined public education. But it was also the year that attacks of 9/11 occurred. And, you know, one day in my classroom, I saw the smoke rising from the Pentagon and were in a panic about what had happened and did our best to calm the students. But I learned a lot teaching that first year in Southeast D.C. because on my way to school, I would pass the White House, and a few minutes later, I'd be in one of the worst ghettos this country has to offer. Such an impoverished neighborhood, and the school building that was literally collapsing. I mean, I had a hole in the ceiling of my classroom, and it flooded my room and actually destroyed the first assignment I ever assigned to the students, a U.S. history project about someone they admired from history. And so what I learned that year was that our nation could pass legislation to blame educators for the state of education with the No Child Left Behind Act, but couldn't find the money to give our kids a basketball hoop on the playground. Our nation could find the money instantly to go bomb Afghanistan and destroy schools and kill kids, but couldn't find the money to fix the hole in the ceiling of my classroom. To see such stark contradictions of immense wealth in the halls of government, the most powerful people in the world, going to work every day next to completely segregated school, 100% African American, and impoverished school, I think really gave me a deep insight into the structural racism and inequality that our country is really immersed in, and also gave me an understanding of the deep educational crisis that exists in this country, not in the way they frame it in terms of test scores, but in terms of a lack of commitment by our government to really support and nurture our students and their education.
So you've actually seen the entirety of No Child Left Behind and the corporate turn, the sort of neoliberal turn in educational policy and the attack on teachers and students, but particularly poor kids. Tell us about that. Well, how did it affect your classrooms, both in Washington, D.C., and then you went to Seattle?
That's right. Yeah, my entire teaching career has been marked by this punitive No Child Left Behind policy. The turnaround model where if the test scores fall, you replace the entire staff. That happened to me at my school in D.C., destabilizing the school, meaning the people that best understood the community and that knew what was happening in the schools and had relationships with the students are pushed out. Instead of given the resources they need to be more successful, they're scapegoated for the government's refusal to support our kids. I've seen just countless teachers get frustrated and burn out because of being told they have to teach to the test. When evaluations are tied to these high-stakes exams, then the passions that brought the teachers into the education field in the first place are no longer relevant, and they have to abandon the things that they care most about that they want to impart to the students and instead prepare the students for the next exam. Because what No Child Left Behind is about, and the subsequent legislation of Race to the Top and now the new Common Core curriculum, all of these education policies that are being pushed by the corporate education reformers rely on reducing the intellectual process of teaching and learning to a single number that they then use to deny kids graduation. They use to shut schools down, label them failing, close them, and then in some instances reopen them as privatized charter schools. Or they use them to bust up teachers' unions by eliminating seniority protections and instead basing teachers' employment on fluctuating test scores, which statisticians have shown are more closely aligned to a student's background and their income level rather than any contributing factors of teachers. And yet the testocracy, as I call them, who push the high-stakes testing are ignoring the science. They're ignoring the research that shows that what high-stakes standardized testing measures above all else is a student's access to resources. It's a better measure of their zip code, right, where they live and the wealth in that area than it is of their aptitude. And I think that's why a new movement is exploding across the country in opposition to high-stakes standardized testing.
Jesse, let's talk about that new movement. At least teachers I know find themselves in the position of telling students they failed. That is, the tests show that your skills are not quite as good as some of the kids in suburban schools, and you're part of a failing class. And then, of course, it's partly a tracking system in that they get tracked into dumbed-down rote kind of learning in order to develop these rote skills. Tell us about that. How do you not do that under this regime, which is to tell kids of their failures when many of them have made great gains and are developing all sorts of skills and have huge amounts of promise?
Absolutely. I mean, standardized testing is such a poor measure of all the things that matter most. It can't judge creativity or critical thinking. Standardized testing cannot measure imagination or civic courage. It can't measure your commitment to an issue that you care about and your ability to problem solve and identify a problem in your community and work and collaborate with others to solve that problem. The skills that we really need to develop in a society as unequal as ours is, in terms of how to build partnerships and empathy with others in order to solve problems, aren't measured. And instead, these tests are used to track students, as you suggested. These tests first came online in the public schools beginning back in the early 1900s. And by 1920, some 2 million kids were taking standardized tests in schools, mostly for the use of tracking, right? And standardized tests are a huge sorting system that are used in the schools to sort and rank students into different strata of education and then feed them into different stratas of wealth in our society. And so far from eliminating barriers, they're actually used to label large swaths of students as failing and track them into low-level classes and then into low-paying jobs.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jesse Hagopian. He's going to be in Portland this Saturday addressing the issues of social justice unionism. Jesse, you're a master at it, at building coalitions, at working with parents and students, and you've written about and edited a book about the ways parents, students, and teachers can fight for better schools. Jesse Hagopian, you earlier talked about the emerging movement. It's getting stronger. It's really challenging the corporate reformers. Give us some examples of what's going on in many places around the United States.
Well, we are in the middle of the largest uprising against high-stakes testing in U.S. history. And never before have more parents, students, and teachers and community members engaged in acts of resistance to these high-stakes tests, to being labeled a number. There were 200,000 parents that chose to opt their kids out of the test in New York State alone this past spring. This school year, there was the largest walkout in U.S. history against high-stakes tests in Colorado, when thousands of students across the state refused to take the high-stakes exit exams and took to the streets, marching and chanting for a better education. And teachers across the country have been at the forefront of this revolt. At my own high school, Garfield High School, 2 years ago, we helped launch this new uprising by refusing to administer the MAP test to students, even when a consequence of a 10-day suspension without pay was leveled against the teachers, especially those in the tested subjects of math and reading. And when they didn't back down, I think it helped inspire educators across the country. And we've seen teachers refuse to give the exams all over, from Toledo to New York to Chicago. Teachers are rising up as well and trying to reclaim their classrooms and make them places for empowering pedagogy rather than implementing this corporate idea of education that ties narrowly to fact-based bubble testing. The strength of this uprising is the connections between parents, students, and teachers. that are increasingly being forged, because I think the secret to our ability lies in the power in numbers. The testocracy, they're the richest people that have ever existed in the history of humanity. We're talking about Bill Gates, Eli Broad, the Walmart family, the Waltons, who have invested their billions of dollars in trying to privatize education, the last public good that's open to all, and they've invested their wealth in trying to destabilize teachers' unions, the biggest unions left standing after 30, 40 years of this neoliberal assault. We're seeing a new movement rise up that's demanding the teachers' unions become more than narrow bargaining units, but that they reach out to the communities they serve and build coalitions. And that's what we've seen in places like Chicago when they had their strike in 2012. Chicago Teachers Union leader Karen Lewis, a black woman who was at the forefront of forging community relationships, especially in the black community, fighting for the stopping of school closures in that community. We saw it in Portland as well when they rose up in a near strike but was able to avert it and actually have a huge victory against testing because they led with the slogan, fighting for the schools our children deserve, and built partnerships with parents and students. And I think that that model shows that when we come together, that the power of our numbers is stronger than the power of their dollars.
You know, in part, there was an extraordinary struggle under that slogan, the schools, Portland students deserve. But what I thought that was the most impressive thing was how committed parents were to their local schools and teachers and their experience with teachers. Parents were, of course, opposed to testing. And the suburban schools and the better schools, they don't even bother with the testing. I mean, they do it, but they don't allow the curriculum to be destroyed. Somehow the richest people would never force their kids to submit to these testing regimes. And the dumbing down of curriculum that they think is appropriate for poor people, or for, in fact, the entire working class, that's, of course, another matter. It seems to me that, at least in Portland, the sense that I got, and I went out on teams to many of the schools, talking to parents, actually, standing in the parking lots and gaining support. And one thing stood out is they really liked their teachers, and they liked the schools, and they liked what was happening to their kids. That is, the parents who were really supportive. And I think parents did that because they really liked what was happening. In many of the schools that I went to, it seems to me fundamental to teachers to continue working to maintain that confidence and that support. That's really at least my conclusion. That was the basis of the victory, was coming to the support of the schools and the teachers and their kids.
Well, I would say that we just saw the power of teachers' unions aligning with the communities they serve right here in Seattle, because this past Tuesday, my union, the Seattle Education Association, went on a one-day strike. And we had some 6,000 people marching in red shirts demanding fully funded schools here in Washington State. We're in a state where the state legislature is refusing to implement the state Supreme Court's mandate that they follow the state constitution, which reads that education is the paramount duty of the state and that they have to fully fund it. And the legislature continues to neglect our schools, funding only 5 periods when we teach 6, slashing money so that we don't have funds for our counseling services. All the elementary schools lost funding to their counselors, and transportation services have been slashed, so those yellow buses are now antiquated and no longer really serve Seattle schools at all. We've lost elective courses, and it's just been absolutely travesty in one of the world's richest regions with Amazon and Starbucks and Microsoft and Boeing all located here. We see that the legislature can't come up with the money to fund our schools. And now there's a new force as a rolling strike wave across Washington State and one-day strikes has really changed the discussion in our state and is connecting with parents. I mean, we saw hundreds of parents come out to rally with the teachers. And I think that that's a sign that parents know that the testocracy's lies are not going to improve public education. The idea that that testing students over and over and over and over again all year long is going to improve education has just proven to be false over the last 13 years of the No Child Left Behind Act, which researchers have shown hasn't improved education and in fact has increased the achievement gap over the time of this test and punish regime. And so I think that many communities are seeing through those lies. At the same time, I think that educators need to make a commitment to education serving all communities and have to fight to dramatically improve public education as well, because I think the public schools in this country, as much as I defend them, also have a history of being used to rank and sort, and I think oftentimes have been part of system of institutional racism that exists throughout our society. And so I think it's incumbent upon educators to educate against oppression, to actually take up issues of structural racism and sexism and homophobia and inequality. And education should be about empowering our students to solve those problems. And I think that when parents see their students being empowered by the education system, that is the deepest kind of connection to a community that you can forge. And I know that because of the work that we've done at Garfield High School with the Black Student Union and seeing them take the lead in the Black Lives Matter movement was instrumental in the Seattle NAACP joining in the struggle against high-stakes testing and calling for parents to opt out of the new Common Core exams. And so I think that the struggle for public education and against the corporate reformers needs to not only oppose those wealthy elites, but also fight for a whole different vision of public education that is about empowering our youth to fight back against the problems that they see in their communities. We need to fight for a whole different idea of what assessment can be. Rather than the ability to eliminate a wrong answer choice on a standardized test, we need to fight for visions of assessment like the performance-based assessments that are in the New York Consortium schools, where students actually develop thesis statements, do research over time, and then defend their thesis, much like a PhD candidate would, to a panel of experts. And that style of assessment we're finding is actually empowering kids with critical thinking skills and is having far superior outcomes in schools that have turned to that form of assessment. So we are in a huge struggle today, but I can tell you that their side is very worried about the gaining momentum of this unity of parents, students, and teachers.
Jesse Agopian, thanks so much for talking to us, and see you next Saturday in Portland. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Jesse will be in Portland this Saturday at the Portland Troublemakers School. Sponsored by the monthly journal Labor Notes, it's a monthly journal, but more a real, well-produced 16 or 24-page with pictures and colors and newsletter reporting on labor fightback around this country, also Mexico, Canada, and others. The Troublemakers School is for troublemakers of all kinds, community organizers, shop stewards, movement activists. They come together for skill building, strategy discussion, and comparing notes. Great talks and workshops. That's this Saturday, lunch provided, a whole day of organizing till 5 p.m. It's $10, but scholarships provided, also rides provided to the site. For all the information, Google Portland Troublemakers School 2015, or go directly to the Facebook page.
Stop it. side by side, marching across the fields where a million fascists died. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists about. Take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery. For this war is one you're bound to lose. Are you fascists or bound to lose? Are you fascists about to lose? You fascists about to lose. You fascists about to lose. You're about to lose. You fascists about.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. That was a little bit of Billy Bragg and Wilco doing All You Fascists with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with radical teacher and Rethinking Schools editor Jesse Hagopian about resisting the testocracy that's undermining the real work of education and about the Labor Notes Troublemaker School that will help us defeat all those fascists. Today is Memorial Day, so we're also talking about memory and the military, as well as about education and labor. All of those institutions arose in their modern disciplinary forms in the 18th century, along with the rise of capitalism. The process of disciplining bodies through the school, the army, the factory, were all parts of the process of extracting maximum surplus value from the populace. But what begins as a series of closed systems has now become an assemblage of techniques of control that interpenetrate and overlap. Take, for instance, education and the military. Our current education budget is only about 2% of the federal budget, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about a tenth of what we spend on the military. And of course, that education money often goes to testing rather than repairs, because if we spent money getting students out of poverty, what would happen to the poverty draft? Education spending locally also supports the military, including programs like Junior ROTC. In general, the federal subsidy covers less than half the total salaries and none of the employment taxes or benefits for JROTC instructors. Schools wind up using extra money from their budgets to, in effect, subsidize a high school military training and recruiting program for the Pentagon. Those last sentences are the words of Sylvia Magali, who teaches at Reynolds High School in Troutdale, and who last year published an essay in Rethinking Schools magazine titled "The Military Invasion of My High School, The Role of JROTC." The No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 requires all schools receiving federal funds to allow military recruiters on campus. Reynolds School District, a high-poverty, culturally diverse district with two of the poorest elementary schools in the state of Oregon, is perfect prey for military recruiters who win points for filling the coffers of the poverty draft. Magali describes how many of her students are enamored with the military's alluring promises of a magic carpet ride away from poverty and uncertainty. But military recruiters and JROTC personnel are notorious for not disclosing the whole truth and for making seductive promises, verbally and in writing, that can be broken at any time. Many people think, well, the military is a good option, or perhaps the only option for many kids. But Magali points out that the potent presence of the military at Reynolds High School shines a floodlight on educational inequity. One sees college recruiters walking the halls of affluent Lincoln High School near downtown Portland. At Reynolds High, college recruiters are few and far between, but military recruiters, junior ROTC commanders, and armed services vocational aptitude battery testers clamor to establish daily contact with potential recruits. The National Defense Act of 1916 established JROTC to increase the U.S. Army's readiness in the face of World War I. The ROTC Vitalization Act of 1964 directed the secretaries of each military branch to establish and maintain JROTC units for their respective branches. In the 1990s, the programs began expanding rapidly throughout the country. Today, there are approximately 3,500 Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard JROTC units in schools in the United States and its territories. In 2013, Congress instructed the Secretary of Defense to expand further and to report on efforts to increase distribution of units in educationally and economically deprived areas. As in these times recently reported, there are even military programs in some middle schools. As Magali points out, JROTC is not about education, but by housing recruiters and JROTC in public schools and offering them carte blanche privileges, schools provide them a cloak of legitimacy. Militarism was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s giant triplets of societal destruction, along with racism and extreme materialism. Yet today, it appears as a legitimate component of the educational system, most often at underfunded schools. At Reynolds, JROTC is an actual school within a school, one that offers four levels of classes for which students earn full credits. It meets state requirements for career training, can substitute for other physical education classes, offers credit for writing and study skills classes, and is hoping to expand its array of credit offerings. JROTC instructors are not certified in the same way as other school district teachers. In some states, they're not required to have more than a GED. Generally, the military decides who's qualified to be a JROTC instructor and then presents them to the school district for hiring. There is no required teacher training. At Reynolds, student loads for most non-JROTC teachers hover between 180 and 220 students, more than twice the load of JROTC instructors, who have student loads of 70 to 90. And what do they teach in these courses? As you might imagine, it's not good. Magali provides several examples, as does the organization Code Pink on their webpage devoted to military recruiting, where you can also download a copy of some of the materials the JROTC use in schools. The Pentagon contracts with Pearson to write JROTC curriculum, including social studies, health, and leadership textbooks. The local school district has no control over their content. No process exists for regular, certified staff to review JROTC materials for appropriateness, accuracy, or conformity to educational standards. And despite the programs in many schools, including Reynolds, to promote nonviolent dispute resolution with restorative justice programs and peer mediation, JROTC's introduction of weapons training, its partnership with the NRA to sponsor marksmanship matches, and its modeling of authoritarian, militaristic solutions to problems contradict the school's stated opposition to violence. Last June, one avid JROTC student at Reynolds High School armed himself with a semi-automatic rifle and pistol, a knife, and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. He fatally shot one student and injured a teacher before police cornered him and he took his own life. The tragedy highlights the importance of closing down programs that feed violent tendencies in vulnerable students and contradict school-based efforts to teach nonviolent conflict resolution. But as Magali notes, critics have been successful in getting JROTC to discontinue the use of live weapons in schools on a national level. But the units continue to use air rifles for target practice at Reynolds High School and numerous other schools. Organizing makes a difference. In San Diego, for example, the Education Not Arms Coalition, made up of students, teachers, parents, and community groups, successfully removed target practice with air rifles from San Diego JROTC programs. JROTC is a component of the U.S. military apparatus, what King called the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And nothing about the current world situation would encourage him to modify that statement. For more information on resisting the militarization of schools, you can check out the resources at the National Network Opposing the Militarization of Youth, as well as Code Pink, the War Resisters League, and more, available on my KBOO blog. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle.
upside eve of America, upside eve of the world, upside the boys in uniform, their mothers and their faithful girls. Listen to the voice of the soldier down in the killing zone, talking about the cost of living and the price of bringing him home. They're already shipping the body bags down below the Rio Grande. But you can fight for democracy at home and not in some foreign land. And the fate of the great United States is entwined in the fate of us all. And the incident at Chernobyl proves that where we're living is very small. And the cities of Europe have burned before, and they may yet burn again. And if they do, I hope you understand that Washington will burn with them. Washington will burn with them. Washington will burn with them.
That was Billy Bragg singing Help Save the Youth of America. And before that, I shared some comments on the militarizing of American education, courtesy of Sylvia Magali in Rethinking Schools. Coming up, we'll hear from Desiree Helligers about some of the lingering effects of military use of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and Clayton Morgeridge will talk about veterans' relation to the civilian world they return to, if they're lucky. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We come to you every Monday at 9 a.m. with news, views, reviews, and interviews, the grassroots perspective on rooting out the ills of capitalism. You can find audio of the show later this week by visiting our KBOO page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab. Next, we'll be hearing from Desiree Helligers, who recently participated in a Veterans for Peace delegation to Vietnam and reflects on Monsanto's role as one of the leading producers of the defoliant Agent Orange used during the war.
It seems appropriate this year that Memorial Day comes so closely on the heels of Saturday's worldwide march against Monsanto. Today we take time to remember Monsanto's role as one of the largest manufacturers of the defoliant Agent Orange used in the Vietnam War. Under the auspices of Operation Ranch Hand, the U.S. military sprayed an estimated 20 million gallons of the dioxin-laced herbicide on Vietnamese jungles, rice paddies, and farmlands, contaminating in the process American and Allied soldiers along with Vietnamese combatants and civilians in what undoubtedly qualifies as one of the largest, most reckless scientific experiments in history. My own limited firsthand encounter with the enormity of the suffering caused by Agent Orange in Vietnam came as part of a two-week delegation led by Veterans for Peace Chapter 160. VFP Chapter 160 was chartered in 2009 by a group of American veterans who now live in Vietnam and are committed to supporting the work of Vietnamese NGOs addressing Agent Orange contamination and the daily threats posed by unexploded ordnance, the landmines, cluster bombs that still litter the Vietnamese landscape today. Among the regions in Vietnam that were hardest hit by the war is Quang Tri Province in the area that the U.S. designated the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ. Quang Tri was subjected to more intense spraying and bombing than any other area in Vietnam, and numbers among an estimated 28 Agent Orange hotspots. An estimated 15,000 people in Quang Tri Province suffer from health effects related to Agent Orange exposure. In Quang Tri, we visited with a family with five adult children, all born between the 1970s and 1980s, but only one of whom seemed to have dodged the chemical bullet of Agent Orange. Four out of the five adult children that we met during our visit were wholly incapable of walking upright due to a host of congenital health problems. They scurried about on all fours, their perpetually puzzled expressions, indications of the developmental disabilities that are among the range of health problems associated with Agent Orange exposure. Like so many elderly parents caring for adult children disabled by Agent Orange, the parents, both in their late 60s, had no doubt expected that their children would one day be able to help shoulder the economic load of supporting the family. Instead, they found themselves in old age struggling to eke out a living in the fields while simultaneously dealing with seemingly limitless responsibilities as caretakers. In Quang Tri Province, an estimated 1,300 families have between 3 and 5 children suffering from the disabling effects of Agent Orange exposure. In Da Nang, we visited a home where 2 elderly women were caring for 2 adult children, a 36-year-old woman and a 40-year-old man. The 2 are among many AO sufferers who appear healthy into adolescence only to decline both cognitively and physically. The 40-year-old lay inert and moaning in a back room, his emaciated and tangled limbs a grim and daily reminder to his younger sister of what her own future might hold. In Ho Chi Minh City, we visited Peace Village at the Dudu Hospital, which is home to some 60 AO-affected children whose parents are unable to cope with their complex needs. If the text of the 2008 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, is any indication, however, the U.S. government has no intention of making Agent Orange the focus of national soul-searching anytime soon. The NDAA charged the Department of Defense with coordinating a series of commemorative events, public programs, and educational materials to mark the 50th anniversary of the war. Stretching out more than a decade, the programs would give the Department of Defense substantial power over shaping public understanding of the war in Vietnam. Among the 5 objectives outlined in the NDAA is a mandate that the DoD history commemorate and presumably celebrate, quote, advances in technology, science, and medicine related to military research conducted during the Vietnam War, unquote. It's telling that while public universities are increasingly treating history as a disposable discipline to be pared back in response to a manufactured financial crisis, the Pentagon clearly understands all too well the importance of controlling history and has the funds and the necessary access to corporate media to circulate its revisionist history. It seems likely that one of the most stark and succinct counterpoints to the Pentagon's revisionist history might be found in Martin Luther King's 1967 speech at Riverside Church. King called out the American refusal to recognize Vietnamese independence, beginning with their 1945 Declaration of Independence, modeled on the U.S.'s own founding documents. He called out the corruption of the U.S.-supported Diem regime in South Vietnam and the disconnect between the promise of democracy in Vietnam and the material conditions of poor communities of color in the U.S., where people were sent off to kill and die in disproportionate numbers to guarantee liberties, as he said, in Southeast Asia, which they could not find in Southwest Georgia. And King spoke of how the Vietnamese must feel watching as we, quote, poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. What do the peasants think, he asked, as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform. What do they think, he asked, as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? What are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? King asked. King's 1967 speech, however, is unlikely to earn pride of place in the DoD's history of the Vietnam War. In the U.S., it took almost a decade of legal wrangling for American veterans of the war in Vietnam to secure a legal settlement providing some limited relief for a wide range of health effects related to Agent Orange exposure. But an estimated 3 million Vietnamese suffering from the health effects of Agent Orange exposure have yet to secure any justice or financial support from the U.S. or the chemical companies, including Monsanto, which produced Agent Orange. But on April 30th of this year, Representative Barbara Lee introduced the Agent Orange Victims Relief Act of 2015, which would not only provide funds to assist Vietnamese suffering from Agent Orange-related conditions, but would also provide much-needed remediation for hotspots throughout Vietnam, along with expanding support for American veterans and their Agent Orange-affected children. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empire's
is merely privilege extended unless enjoyed by one and all. Some are brothers and sisters, for the struggle carries on. The Internationale unites the world in song. So
that was Billy Bragg's version of the Internationale, the classic anthem of global solidarity among the working class. Before that, we heard from Desiree Hellegers about our need to address some of the lingering effects of the military enforcement of the interests of capitalism and the toxic legacy of Monsanto's Agent Orange. You can also find a more extended account of that trip to Vietnam online in the May 8 through 10 issue of Counterpunch. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host this Memorial Day, Fran Michel. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. You can find audio of our show with additional information posted under the audio tab on our page on the KBOO website in a day or two. Next, and finally on today's show, we hear from Clayton Morgeridge with some comments from veterans' perspectives.
Thanks, Fran. Well, Memorial Day is supposed to be a day when we remember and honor those who died in our nation's wars. Veterans Day, later in November, is a time to honor those who fought and did not die. Both these days are part of the national rhetoric that teaches us and our children that it is always honorable to join the military, risk one's life, and kill others on the orders of one's superiors. We are often encouraged to thank soldiers and veterans we meet for their service, quote unquote. But one veteran asks us not to thank him, and here is his reasoning. This is by Camillo MacBica, a former Marine Corps officer, Vietnam veteran, longtime activist for peace and social justice, and he's the coordinator of the Long Island chapter for Veterans for Peace. It was published in Truth Out. I do not want to appear disrespectful or ungrateful, but should we meet on the street one day, do say hello or fine day or something like that, but please do not thank me for my service as a United States Marine. I make this request because my service, as you refer to it, was basically either to train to become a killer or to actually kill people and blow stuff up. Now, that is not something for which a person should be proud nor thanked. In fact, it is regrettable, and for me, a source of guilt and shame, something I will have to live with for the rest of my life, as the past cannot ever be undone. So when you thank me for my service, it disturbs me a lot. First off, it brings to mind my wasted youth and lost innocence, and the horrible and unnecessary deaths of good friends and comrades. Second, it reminds me of my responsibility and culpability for the pain and suffering I caused innocent people. Again, something I would rather forget, but cannot. Third, it reinforces my belief that you have absolutely no idea about the nature and reality of the wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, because if you did, you would understand that thanks are inappropriate. Fourth, it reminds me that many of those who feel the need to offer thanks were apathetic about or even supportive of the war, while they refused to participate themselves or did little or nothing to end it. And lastly, I have to admit that I doubt the sincerity of these expressions of supposed gratitude as thank you for your service is just something to say, not because you care about what I did or sacrificed, but only to demonstrate your supposed good character or patriotism and or support for members of the military and veterans. In making this request not to be thanked for my service, I am, of course, expressing only my opinion and perhaps my idiosyncrasy, and I make no claim to be speaking for other veterans. I would wager, however, that many, perhaps even most, who have experienced the horrors of war and have the courage and presence of mind to think about and evaluate what the war they served in was truly about would understand and probably concur with this request. Those veterans, however, who may not agree, who cling to the mythology of heroism, glory, honor, and nobility of war, do so in large measure from fear that acknowledging war's reality would somehow diminish their sacrifice and the sacrifices of those whose lives were lost. Perhaps understandably, they view such sacrifices and loss as difficult enough to live with when they had value and purpose, but as intolerable if they were misguided and unnecessary. To these brothers and sisters, I would offer the following questions and observations for them to ponder. First, what was accomplished by your sacrifice and by the waste of lives and treasure in Vietnam, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan? Where is the honor, glory, and nobility in killing and dying for greed, incompetence, and paranoia? Second, the mythology you cling to for comfort is a tool of political leaders to make war palatable, to garner support for their militarism and abandonment of diplomacy. It is what motivates future idealistic, perhaps naive, young people to, quote, heed the call to seek honor and glory by enlisting in the military to fight for a cause they have been deceived into believing is right, just, and necessary, but which is in reality a string of wars for corporate greed, power, and hegemony. All who are touched by war are tainted and require readjustment, perhaps even rehabilitation. But in order to truly come home from war, to make the perilous journey of healing, one must face the realities of one's own war experience head on, as no healing is possible from fantasy, myth, rationalization, and distortion of truth. So in the future, if you really insist on thanking me for something, do not thank me for the 8 years I spent as a Marine, but for the 45 or so years following my discharge from the military that I have spent as an activist fighting for human rights and social justice and to end the insanity of war. Frankly, however, I would prefer that you just say hello or fine day. You see, my activism all these years warrants no praise or merit, as it is not something I choose to do. Rather, I do it because I must, perhaps as penance for my culpability for the sacrilege of war. And if you truly want to demonstrate your good character, patriotism, and support for the troops and veterans, rather than merely mouth meaningless expressions of gratitude for something you don't truly understand or care much about, do something meaningful and real. Do what is truly in the interest of this nation and of those victimized by war. Make some demands. Demand, for example, an immediate end to the corporate takeover of our democracy and to the undue influence of the military-industrial congressional complex. Demand sanity in Pentagon spending and a reallocation of finite resources to people-focused programs such as health care, education, and jobs, rather than to killing and destruction. Demand an immediate end to wars for corporate profit, greed, power, and hegemony. Demand that we adhere to the Constitution and to international law. Demand accountability for those who make war easily and care more for wealth, profit, and power than for national interest or for the welfare of their fellow human beings. And finally, demand the troops be brought home now so that they may be adequately treated and cared for when they return. So, should we meet on the street one day, do say hello or fine day, and as you talk to me about your efforts to make this country and the world a better and more peaceful place in which to live, I would be happy to thank you for your service. I've been reading from Camillo Macbica's piece called Don't Thank Me for My Service. It appeared right on Memorial Day weekend in 2012. In Truth Out, and we'll link to it on the webpage for the show. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Blue eyes, spikes in the gray eyes. Fights in the tears, armed to the teeth for a
war words reaching all the years. I advanced across a poppy field. I saw the gleam as you raised your shield and love screamed out with the sun behind its back. Our fathers rule soldiers. Should we be soldiers too? Fighting and falling like soldiers do. Nothing is clear in this tactical unclear.
That was Billy Bragg singing Like Soldiers Do, and before that, Clayton Morgridge sharing a veteran's perspective on service. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Jesse Hagopian. Thanks to Desiree Heligers and Clayton Morgridge. Thanks to Billy Bragg for the music. Thanks to Patsy Kullberg for engineering. My name is Fran Michel. I've been your host. Thanks to you, KBOO members. Email us your feedback at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. You can like the show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our show page here at kboo.com will have links to more information about Troublemaker School, the victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2015, and other topics raised on today's show. We'll be back next week with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from under the grassroots. Stay tuned to KBOO. At 10 o'clock, we'll hear Eric Cascadia presenting headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Dan Saris, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. We'll talk about proposals to build oil, coal, and LNG terminals across the Northwest. At 11, we'll hear Disability Awareness with host Grace Eagle Reed, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. At 11:30 on the Monday Morning Radio Zine, we'll hear Preeti Shah and Rudy DeCruz, core managers with City Repair, about the upcoming Village Building Convergence, featuring placemaking, permaculture, equity, diversity, and multiculturalism within the sustainability movement. Thank you again to all listeners who support our radio station, your radio station. If you've not yet made your commitment to non-commercial community radio, please do surf on over to kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Storefront was a thriving theater company in Portland, which closed in 1991. Triangle Theater is bringing back some of the burlesque acts and performances from this bygone era. Again, that's the Storefront Review, produced by the Triangle Theater from May 7th through the 30th at the Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
And it is a minute before 10 a.m. Coming up at 10 a.m. will be, of course, Air Cascadia. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. At 10:15 today, Locus Focus has host Barbara Bernstein talks with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about proposals to build oil, coal, and LNG terminals across the Northwest and the opposition these proposals face from broad segments of the community. And, of course, at 11, it's Grace Eagle Reed with Disability Awareness. And at today at 11:30 on the radio scene, we speak with City Repair Corps managers Pretty Shaw and Rudy DeCruz about issues of placemaking, gentrification, equity, diversity, and multiculturalism within the sustainability movement and about the upcoming village building convergence. So thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, join. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, May 25th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Our guest today, Jody McCaffrey, is coming on to talk to you about the significance